passport, check. Euros, check. Train ticket, check.
Oh no, I forgot the Flight Free podcast.
Check in with the Flight Free podcast. Imagine where we can take you. Don't forget to carry us in your pocket for destination inspiration.
Hello and welcome to the Flight Free podcast. I'm Evie, and in this episode, we're going to be thinking about the impact of sport on the climate. We're really excited to welcome Olympians Etienne Stott and Laura Baldwin to the podcast. Etienne was a gold medalist in canoe slalom at the London 2012 Olympics, and Laura is a British sailor who competed in the 2004 Summer Olympics. Sport is loved by millions of people all around the world and is an essential aspect of society. Playing a sport can enhance the physical and mental well-being of individuals, and supporting a team can make you feel a part of something truly special. However, do we ever consider its cost to the planet? One of the major environmental impacts of sports is travel. This includes athletes competing in events all over the world, including the Olympic Games and other international competitions, but also from fans who will travel, often many miles by air, to keep up with their favourite teams. Yet sport can be a powerful motivator and has the ability to unite people, create hope, and inspire change. So we want to explore if sport could have a role to play in driving climate awareness and empowering people to take action. Before we get on with the questions, let's have this month's Flight Free Fact.
Flight Free Fact.
The climate crisis is already affecting the sports we play. By 2050, it's estimated that almost 1 in 4 English Football League grounds can expect flooding every year. Of the 19 venues that have already hosted the Winter Olympics, just 10 will be able to hold them by 2050. And cricket venues in places such as Australia, India, and the West Indies will see a 60% increase in days with temperatures over 40 degrees Celsius over the next decade. Now it's time to hear from our guests. So hi, Etienne and Laura. Thanks so much for joining us. Let's start with an easy question. Can you give a quick outline of your careers as athletes? Etienne, you can go first.
I started canoeing when I was about 10 or 11 in the Scouts, but I wasn't from a sporty family or anything. Basically, I just was interested in it just a little bit, and then I joined a local club and kind of took a fairly large leap of imagination and just decided to try to become an Olympic and world champion. In fact, I kind of felt like it was possible to be the best canoeist the world had ever seen. So I just started going canoeing more often and training more and more seriously. And it took me around about 20 years to get to, you know, the London Games when I was 33, when Tim, my crewmate, and I won the London Games. Winning in the home Olympics is just, you can't get luckier than that, as well as being good at it. You've got to be really lucky. So, yeah, that's kind of where I suppose I see myself in that.
And Laura, how about you?
It was between college and university that I went on a 2-week sailing holiday, and I learned there the very basics of sailing racing. And within that 2 weeks, I improved so much. The instructor actually pulled me up and said, "You know what? You could be a world champion at this." I decided to take a gap year to really focus on learning all the skills. And during that year, watched the Sydney 2000 Olympics. And Shirley Robertson won gold, and she was 12 years older than me. I had this crazy idea. I'm like, I wonder if it's possible, if I applied myself to a sport like I am to my degree, if I could come out the same period of time an athlete instead of an academic. And so I set myself I persuaded my dad. I managed to convince him to let me have a go at this. Bought all the gear, you know. A few years down the line, everybody confessed that I was the joke on tour. Like, all the gear, no idea. Who does she think she is that she can make it to the Olympics? Never been in any team whatsoever. And here I am on the Olympic circuit, coming lucky last in most races. And so I'd set myself the goal of London 2012, maybe Beijing 2008. But actually, I qualified in just 3 years. So it just shows that if you fully apply yourself, and I think I had the advantage of not having any bad habits, being totally fresh and new to it, getting the world's best coaches, all of those that had input into Shirley's campaign to help me. Yeah, help me to become successful.
Wow, that sounds so amazing. I think there's definitely a life lesson in there for all of us. So since leaving full-time sport, you've both become involved in Extinction Rebellion. Could you tell us a bit about that and your motivations?
After Athens 2004, I tried to go to Beijing 2008, lost the trials, went out to Australia, and I lived out there for a decade. And living in Australia, you really get to see climate change in action. It's the sunburnt country, you know, you heat waves of 48 degrees I experienced out there. The rains and the tropical storms are just crazy. You're just kind of like, whoa, is this actually happening? They're so intense. I lived out there, for 10 years and came back here. I coached at two Olympic Games. And upon my return here, January 2019, I got asked by my first sailing training partner to meet her in Zurich. She's American. She was flying out there to go to the World Economic Forum in Davos. She's like, I've got this great hotel, like, come join me for the weekend. So of course I did, you know, what you do when you have no carbon conscience, you book a flight and off you go. You have a lovely weekend. Although that weekend completely changed my life from that moment. It was my bubble of contentment popped. She had to read these papers before attending the forum and she had jet lag, headache. So I read them to her. She fell asleep. I kept reading them. And it was like reading a script for a horror movie. It was also the first time that I heard Greta Thunberg stood outside in the snow. And I turned to my friend, I'm like, is what this kid's saying for real? How have I not known this? Like, the shock is just so immense. I came home and I just spent all my free time watching, reading, studying everything I could about the crisis and also the solutions. I have an 8-year-old son. At the time, he was 6 or 5. And, you know, being a mother and you're thinking, my goodness, my child's future is at risk here. You get deeply protective. So yeah, initially started with making all the eco swaps myself, reducing my own carbon footprint. Then I looked at what I could do to help my community to reduce emissions and to restore nature. But the more I learned, the more I realized it has to be from government. It has to be government that forces the changes. I was meeting far too many people that were just not willing to make the changes themselves. And also realizing that the big changes have to come from government and industry. So I went along to an introductory talk from Extinction Rebellion, and my first action was in Bristol. I went along for a recce to see what an Extinction Rebellion action actually was all about. And I had the most beautiful, connective, colourful, entertaining day out. You know, there was a samba band dancing, very empowering speeches from Gail Bradbrook on board the Pink Boat. We went on a march facilitated by the police. They'd set up a little community where they were feeding people for donations or free if you couldn't afford it. And you could just sit around and sort of talk with like-minded people. And I found it really empowering, really inspiring, very uplifting.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because I sometimes don't quite know how I got here. It was a bit more gradual, I guess, you know, towards the back end of my career. I was always quite orientated throughout my career of kind of having a legacy to try to, you know, pay back and put all of what I'd learned back into the communities and back in to help people. That was really what spurred me on, especially after London. I didn't need to carry on, but I wanted to learn more so I could give more. As my career wrapped up, I also kind of made some of these choices. It seemed, you know, I even before my career finished, I started using my bike to ride to training, things like that. But I became a vegan. I went to like a weekend, it was called the Vegan Camp Out. I just ended up going to these like talks and workshops and lectures about different sorts of activists. And it kind of made me think, actually, these people are trying to change the world in what seems to be a most sensible way, creating less harm and pain. And also it's good for our planet. So that kind of first exposed me to kind of, I suppose, activism, really. Just literally a few weeks later, Extinction Rebellion did their first thing, which was called the Declaration of Rebellion in London. And I watched that on the internet and thought, oh, actually, this is something I could do. And then I went to a training session where, you know, I learned basically about, it's called the theory of change, how things can get changed. And also about the tactics that Extinction Rebellion use, which is called nonviolent civil disobedience, and learning about the consequences of breaking the law in this very specific, limited, peaceful, calm way, how that can actually create the changes. And having learned that, I thought, actually, I believe it's possible for me to participate in this. I believe that great many people could actually do that without having, you know, very serious consequences in their lives, especially when you set that against the consequences of doing nothing, which is our whole lives going wrong.
Yeah, That's so interesting to hear how both of you got there kind of in your different ways. And I definitely think, Laura, the phrase you used of the bubble of contentment bursting, I think definitely so many people who've taken our flight-free pledge have had that moment with air travel. And I definitely had it with sport when researching this episode. So if we start by talking about domestic sport, week in, week out, you'll have school teams traveling, local teams traveling, and professional teams traveling for sports fixtures. So I'd love to know what you both think at a domestic level we could do to encourage more sustainable travel choices.
We are heading to a world where we need to basically be more localized. I myself am just trying to work out how I can do more things locally rather than having to do one thing all around the country, which is kind of what I used to do. And I think when it comes to sports and spectating, participatory sports, you know, making the most of what you can around, you know, we could reimagine sports in different ways. I think it might change sports, the rules of sports, but also it does sometimes create more effort to have mass transport of people. But it's also really fun to travel together with people to places, you know, and using public transport or using bigger transport like coaches or buses can be quite fun. And I just think, again, you know, when people start to realise what the consequences of all of this is, and that there is no magic pill here that we can just swallow and it's all going to be fine. It's not going to be fine at this rate. We need to change. And once people start to understand that has to happen, I think people will start to think there's new options that they might not have liked before might become more open.
So I got a gig on the World Olympians Association Environment Committee, and I've always been a big daydreamer. So I was really pulled in and inspired by Rob Hopkins of Transition Network's book, From What Is to What If, The Power of Just Doing Stuff, and listening to him about how we've got to use the power of our imaginations to dream up the future that we need and want. And with so much needing to change, people focusing and being made to focus on the things that they may we will have to give up in order to cut our emissions, there's going to be a void created and it's going to be needed to be filled by things. And sport and the arts could be that medicine that helps us move through this transition from this world of luxury that we don't even really appreciate, the level of luxury that we live within, that is going to have to be drawn back, that we are going to have to live more simply. And so sport has such a power. It's healthy, it's connecting, it's fulfilling, you know, it's all those positive attributes of being human that we need to really engage within. And so focusing on grassroots, focusing local, focusing on communities, focusing on creating sporting opportunities for all, for everyone, any age, any ability, that is just going on everywhere, you know, really doing a massive boost in local sports. Really emphasizing less, you know, all the federations or the sporting federations need to plan their calendars so there's very few competitions that you travel to, that you all build your levels locally, and then it becomes more of a pinnacle experience to go to the national championships, which perhaps might be the one event that pulls everyone together a year, or perhaps there's a regional championships and then a national championship. But this traveling every weekend to a different part of the UK or even Europe or the world is balmy under the current technologies that we have, that we have to use to power us, that are just so polluting. So that definitely needs to change.
I really like what you're saying there, Laura, as well. I think that talking about the future of sport in a world that we're heading towards, where we've kind of unfortunately left it so late that the difficult choices now are just all difficult choices. But I think with a reimagination, we can get back to what sports is really about. Sports is about the challenge, it's about the endeavour, it's about cooperation. It would be more fun, more creative, it would still have all the physical benefits. I think it would just be changing things slightly. And I really like the idea that it could bring more people in that way, and you could actually allow more people to participate and enjoy. And it would have less of an impact environmentally, but have more of an impact socially, mental health wise, physical health wise, social health wise. I think there's a lot of vision for that myself.
Yeah, I really like the ideas you both have, and I like the way you talk about being more creative. When it comes to international sports travel, it is a lot harder not to fly. Where do you see the future of international sport going, and how can its climate impact be mitigated?
I think Laura touched on it a little bit earlier. I think one of the things that has facilitated international sports, and I can certainly talk about white water slalom, is budget airlines, budget travel. And you know, and the fact that short haul travel has become basically cheaper than traveling on a train inside my own country. Sport needs money to run. And if flights started to cost anywhere near what they should cost, if there was, for example, fuel duty on jet fuel, or if the mitigation for the destruction that they caused was priced into the tickets, all of a sudden flights would become very much more expensive. But I think, if first of all, if sport came to have to deal with that, one of the things that's interesting about sport is it's full of very motivated, quite creative people. If this was organised and managed by the sports federations, sports could be done a lot better. I think also, I really agree with Laura, you know, making the pinnacle events the pinnacle events. So I think the Olympics is a really interesting thing. You know, there's often been talk about making the Olympics into one venue every 4 years. You don't have to rebuild everything. Of course, there's not a construction bonanza. The corruption and the local politics is not as inflated, and all the consequences of that probably in some ways not as lucrative. But actually, there's lots of ways that we could actually have an awesome Olympics every 4 years that people just came to from across the world. It was the pinnacle event. And of course, there would be a very significant carbon impact with that. But it would also have an incredible, I believe, inspirational, feel good. I believe people do like to do the right thing, do like to do good things for other people when they realize what it is. And, you know, it's in a framework set up that people say, you know, this is a cool thing, we're doing it for this reason. People will do that. Again, the future of international sports is really difficult, but the future of everything is difficult. And I actually do think, as Laura says, you know, that the power of entertainment, the power of inspiration, the power of these fundamental human qualities and attributes of these endeavours really is very healthy for us. And we've just got to find a way of engaging with them in a healthy way rather than in a basically destructive way.
So how important is it for professional athletes to use their platforms to raise awareness of things like climate change?
I just completed the Aim High course. It's a 4-part series in learning about the climate crisis and how to communicate about it. And in the second series, it actually says, quite surprisingly, how it used to be scientists and philosophers that were the trusted voice that people would listen to, and that has shifted, and that is now celebrities and sports people who are the trusted voice, way above politicians. It is something that Etienne and I have been engaging within through Champions for Earth, trying to help athletes to find their voice and find a way in which they feel confident to put themselves forward as ambassadors for the environment.
Athletes have got this extraordinary reach because people invest in them, their aspirations and their ideals of what good people are. And that means they can reach people. When someone does something in sports, it has a huge emotional impact as well as on the media. You know, one of my aims or one of my hopes was when I started to become active in Extinction Rebellion and also, you know, doing Champions for Earth and just trying to be visible doing things, is that it would pave the way and embolden other people in the food chain of athletes and famousness. I would say I'm pretty low down there. You know, there's some really big fish swimming around in the tank, and I'm hoping that some of them will say, actually, now is the right time to be step into my responsibility, step into my power, not deny that I have a platform, I have got this power, that I have got some influence, and I should now think about using this for the good of all people, not just for sports. And so I'm hoping that we can do that. But I think it's really interesting to think how we can help people, you know, how sports can help in that, and how sports people can help to be those communicators.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think most people can relate that to people like Marcus Rashford, who's been able to use his celebrity to influence government policy with the free school meals. So it would be so powerful if those high-profile sports stars would talk about the climate. You also both just mentioned Champions for Earth there. Just to explain that for our listeners, this is a movement created by you, Etienne, and Dave Hampton, who we know well here at Flight Free UK, which is about sports stars speaking out about the climate. So Laura, have you had much progress with this?
We've been helping athletes, as I said, and what we found is that the blocker for most of them is this fear of being attacked for hypocrisy. So we've been really helping to create a defence statement, a really solid defence statement over it's system change we need. You know, we're all hypocrites within this system, but a lot of athletes are really trying to do their bit, doing the community litter picks or just litter picks on their own, reducing their single-use plastic, flying less, eating less meat or no meat, going vegan. You know, actually come back with the things that you can say that you're doing and that you're trying to make all the other changes. But at the moment, athletes are what gives people joy, and so for them to continue, it feels right if we can enable it however possible. We can't be paralyzed by this call of hypocrisy. It really is just a distraction technique, trying to discredit so that you're not listening to the important messages that are trying to be communicated.
Yes, that's so true, Laura. A lot of this does come down to structural change. What do you think needs to happen to improve the carbon footprint of sport?
Can I just say the first thing I would say is education. You know, the inconvenient truth is that we've been told by the world's leading scientists that there is this carbon budget to keep the world under 1.5 degrees of global overheating. It sounds like a tiny amount, but that we're only at 1.2 degrees of global overheating now, and you can already see the catastrophic, horrific climate impacts hitting every continent of the globe last summer. And that remaining budget to that 1.5 point, which is the critical threshold where we're warned that past that, tipping points will be passed that then become irreversible. Then when you're told that that remaining budget at the current rate of emissions will be spent within the next 8 years, and the UK's fair share of that will be spent within the next 4 years, you start to realise the immediacy and the urgency of the situation. So first off, education. People need to know the truth. They need to understand how massive and how imminent this crisis actually is. And then we need to start bringing people together to work out how do we reduce our carbon footprint? What changes can we make? With so many changes needing to be made, if you include people in the discussions and the decision-making process, they'll be far more likely to consent to the changes than if they weren't, if they're just told you can't fly anymore. But if they're educated on the problem and included in deliberating what changes should we make, I think that will make for a much more peaceful transition.
That's the really tricky thing here, is to explain the future. It's not just Laura and me saying that this is the case. This is the United Nations chief, Antonio Guterres. There's these hugely credible people who are using language that you would think would be reserved for an existential threat, something that's going to come and destroy us all. And they are saying, this is code red for humanity. We have to change, or everything will be changed. That is really hard, but that's the reality. And once we start to get that, we then have to say, you know, how consistently do we want to stand by our professed ideals of fairness and of kindness and of care for young people? Sports is all about young people, supposedly. Of course, it's for all ages. And we've got to say, you know, what do we want for these youngsters? Because it's now no longer about just teaching them how to go faster in their boat. I'm not saying it for a moment that's easy, but we've got to start to go there. Otherwise, we are just basically going to be shortchanged, and all those young canoeists are going to look at us and say, what the hell were you thinking? What were you doing? You were basically ruining my future while you were gallivanting around. And I'm like, that's horrible. I don't want that. You know, we can have a little bit of fear in there as well to say, actually, we need to, you know, there's a carrot, and we've got to get to the carrot way, which is coming together, figuring this out as sensible, responsible people, rather than just burying our heads in the sand and carrying on playing our sports, which, you know, we can only do for so long before it will become painfully clear that that's not going to work anymore.
What a way to finish. Let's hope that your work with Extinction Rebellion and Champions for Earth really does make people wake up and pay attention to this vital issue, so we can continue to have those amazing benefits from sport without so many of the climate impacts. So thank you again to both of you for joining us today and for taking the time to speak to us. So now it's time for Destination of the Month.
Destination of the Month.
Since we've been talking all about sport, we're going with one of the most famous sport events in the world, which is the Tour de France. And for this, we've got our cycle mad director, Anna, to come and talk to us about it. Hi, Anna.
Hi, Evie. So let me tell you about the Tour de France. It actually starts in Denmark this year, which sounds a bit strange, but they often start it in different countries. It even started in the UK a few years ago. So this year, the stages will be in northern France, down through the Alps, across to the Pyrenees, before finishing at the Champs-Élysées in Paris, which is where it always finishes. It's not a very low carbon race though, actually, because even though it's all on bicycles, because the stages are so far apart, they have to transfer between them, so they drive, which is totally different to how it was the very first time. So the Tour de France started in 1903, and it really was a Tour of France. It was a single loop, so the cyclists rode through the night. It took 3 weeks, a completely crazy event on these old bikes that probably only had one gear. So it's very different to what we have now. So have you ever seen the Tour, Evie? Because you're from France, aren't you?
I've never seen the Tour de France personally, but there was big excitement in the village that I was from a couple of years back. The tour actually went through the village and you can still see the writing on the wall advertising the Tour de France, which is very cool.
Amazing. What's the village?
It's called Bourmont, so it's northeastern France, and it is on a huge hill. And honestly, the fact that they were able to cycle up that hill is very impressive.
So I've picked two destinations that are good for watching the Tour de France this year. And of course, one is the finish line, the finale at the Champs-Élysées in Paris. So Evie, can you give us the info about how to get to Paris without flying?
Yes. So for anyone in the UK, the easiest way to get to Paris without flying would be to take the Eurostar from London. So from St. Pancras, it's a really quick, easy journey. So for whatever part you are in the UK, make your way to London and then get on the Eurostar. Coach is another great way of getting over there. And yes, on the ferry too.
So the other destination I've picked is the Alpe d'Huez. And the reason why the Alpe d'Huez is such a good place to watch the tour is that usually, if you're just a spectator on the road, you would just see all the riders flash past in a few seconds and that's it. But this is a long climb with lots of hairpin bends. So it's 21 hairpins, over 9 miles of climbing. So wherever you are, you can see the riders slowly making their way up. And it's a real festival atmosphere with loads of people from different nationalities congregating on the corners. It's pretty iconic. So you can get there to the Alpe d'Huez by taking a train all the way to Grenoble. And then you would need to take a local bus to the village at the foot of the mountain, which is Le Bourg d'Oisin. The train to Grenoble is pretty easy. You just go via Lille and Lyon. So that's the Eurostar to Lille and then the TGV to Lyon and then a regional train to Grenoble. And it's a really beautiful journey and it doesn't take that much longer than flying.
Well, thank you, Anna, for sharing all your tips with us. And thank you again to our guests for joining us today. And thank you to all of you for listening. If you're inspired to make 2022 your year of being flight free, you can sign up at our website, flightfree.co.uk. And if you have any stories of how you have travelled in a sustainable way to keep up with your favourite sports, we'd love to hear it. Next month, we'll be talking about places that we love in our hometown. So please do join us again then. Thank you for listening. Goodbye.
We hope you enjoyed your journey with the Flight Free podcast. Download the full series on the podcast page of our website. And join us again next month for more inspirational stories and grounded adventures. You can find out more information and inspiration at flightfree.co.uk. Until next time, stay safe and stay grounded.